Welcome to another episode of the Enthusiastic Cast. I'm Mark, he's John. This is the webcast where we enthusiastically recommend one book. This week, John is enthusiastic about two books, actually. Things We Didn't See Coming by Stephen Amsterdam and Astros Pollock by David Mazzucchelli. John, did I say that right?
No.
Ah!
You got the word polyp right, and David.
So anyway, this is a bit of a disaster for us here at the Enthusiastic Cast, because what we realized was that the conversation from 2 weeks ago that we recorded about kind of our favorite or our most anticipated summer movies was a bit of a gong show, a bit of a garble fest, and we've decided not to release that on the blog. But of course, we've referenced it a couple times, both last week when I reviewed or endorsed Carl Malanti's Matterhorn, and I think it's come up on the blog once or twice. So there's a couple A-list movies that that it goes without saying that we're keen about: Scott Pilgrim, Iron Man 2. But we thought that just quickly we would do some of the we would revisit the conversation about kind of the potential sleeper hits this summer that we're keen about that we just wanted to share with you. And so why don't we just jump into that conversation before we get to John's double-barreled endorsement? John, what were the two or three movies that you were stoked about for summertime?
Well, they're hardly what I would call sleeper hits. They're probably going to be big blockbusters if they're any good at all. Sort of, you know, staring down the barrel of the summer, as you mentioned, there's Iron Man 2, there's Scott Pilgrim. I'd add to that Inception, which I've blogged about and I'm very much looking forward to. Add to that, I went on a marathon junket and watched sort of all of the trailers for all of the summer movies that were available this week. And a couple of them that stood out to me, there's a lot of samey stuff coming out. And just sort of out of that, two that held my interest. And at the end of the 30 seconds or a minute or whatever it was, I was like, wow, I kind of want to see that. Believe it or not, one of them is a Bruckheimer production. It's the Nick Cage version of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Something about the Apprentice movie, the callow youth, you know, taken under the wing of the crazy, arrogant expert and taught the ways of the world or magic or whatever. Something about that trope, that storyline really speaks to me. So that one also is directed by John Turteltaub, who's just a workmanlike guy who's been around a long time. So I know that he knows how to tell a story, and he actually did the National Treasure, which was a Nick Cage movie that I've enjoyed more than other Nick Cage movies recently, leaving aside Kick-Ass, which was Kick-Ass. So that one I'm kind of looking forward to. On top of that, I'm not much of a comedy guy, but there's a comedy from Jay Roach, who's, you know, another guy who just sort of, you know, he plugs out a good comedy every couple of years. Dinner for Schmucks with Steve Carell and Paul Rudd, where Paul Rudd is kind of the plot from Dogfight, that old River Phoenix movie, except instead of an unattractive girl, it's a, you know, crazy idiot loser guy, where, you know, there's this sort of cabal of, you know, rich white dudes who invite the biggest doofuses they can find to dinner and then laugh at them all night long. And so Paul Rudd is the conflicted noob who's tasked with bringing his first schmuck, which of course is Steve Carell in you know, uber loser mode. And it just made me laugh, which, you know, that's the only requirement there is for a comedy. The third movie that I was enthusiastic about this summer actually now isn't a summer movie. I just found out today that The Adjustment Bureau with Matt Damon and Emily Blunt, directed by first-time director George Nolfi and based on a Philip Dick story, has been bumped from a July release date to September, which, not a huge vote of confidence. So maybe my early enthusiasm for that is misplaced. We'll wait and see a trailer. I just really like I kind of have a soft spot for first-time directors, particularly when they've been working in the business for a while. Nolfi is a screenwriter. He worked on the last Bourne movie and a few other films. And I just find when these guys get, you know, their first shot at the brass ring, they often bring a lot of passion to that project. I'm thinking specifically of Tony Gilroy and Michael Clayton, which, you know, he's a guy who worked on all the Bourne movies, and he got that shot, and he turned out what I thought was a great film. So I was kind of hoping for the same thing from The Adjustment Bureau. It's the story of a guy who meets a girl, falls in love, and then finds out that there's this group called the Adjustment Bureau, these sort of agents of fate who are tasked with keeping the world on one specific course, and it doesn't involve him being with this girl, so he's got to decide whether or not he's going to go along with what quote-unquote fate has in store for him, or whether he's going to buck that. And I kind of just like the literalism of that motif, and I love those actors, so I had high hopes. Apparently the studio doesn't feel the same way, and maybe they know more than I do. So,
and in our original conversation, we talked about how it was pretty much going up head-to-head with Inception and
similar stuff, and that might be all it is, right? It might just be moving a thematically similar film a little bit further away from its direct competition.
And, you know, the second and third look that we've seen at Inception, this looks stronger and stronger. Nolan, Nolan hasn't made a bad movie, in my opinion, so
no.
They're probably running scared. So we also talked about Jonah Hex, which looks like a fucking Gong Show disaster.
Again, this just makes me doubt myself, because that was one where I was like, I haven't really seen anything about this movie, but I've enjoyed the comic on occasion. I like that it's a little bit different. I like that it's a first-time director, you know, but apparently it's going to be horrible just based on the trailer and all of the buzz about it and the fact that they've held back everything about that film. And then some of the creative choices they appear to have made there are just baffling to me. It really looks like another Will Smith Wild Wild West era, sort of fiasco. So,
So my so just a question about Iron Man, just with the source material and stuff like that. Anytime you have a comic book movie come out with two villains, it makes me kind of uneasy, right? So they have the Scarlett Johansson character is in Iron Man 2, as is she's a villain, right?
She's an anti-hero.
She's an anti-hero, because in looking at it just this week, I was just like, I wonder if they're trying to do too much in this film and introduce too many characters, because of course there already is I actually don't know his character's name, but the guy with the electric bullwhips.
Oh, Whiplash.
Whiplash, right. So you've got that plot, you've got the Scarlett Johansson plot on the go, and then also you've got, of course, the reoccurring plots with Iron Man and his team and of course his girl Friday there. So they're throwing a whack ton of marketing dollars at this movie, so I can't tell if it's overkill and it's going to be too sprawling and too crazy, or if they've been able to keep the storyline tight and concise and awesome.
I think it's actually okay, because, I mean, if you think back to the first one, there was actually two villains in the first one. There was Jeff Bridges as the Iron Monger. I don't know if he was actually named in the film. And then there was also the terrorist guy who ran the Ten Rings organization, which was an allusion to the Iron Man villain, the Mandarin, who had 10 mystical rings of power and was a would-be conqueror. And then if you think about the second Tim Burton Batman movie, that had almost the exact same structure as the new Iron Man movie, where, you know, the Black Widow character is comparable to Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman. You also have the sort of industrialist Captain of Industry character played by Christopher Walken in Batman Returns, and now played by Sam Rockwell as Justin Hammer in the new Iron Man movie. And then you've got the overt quote-unquote supervillain character who was Danny DeVito as the Penguin in Batman Returns and is, of course, played by Mickey Rourke as Whiplash in the new Iron Man. So, you know what? I think it's going to be okay. And I mean, the advance buzz on this movie, it's out now internationally in a number of places. Apparently, it's made $100 million already. So, I think it's good. I think it's going to be okay.
Okay, well, I trust you. So the three kind of movies that were flying under the radar for me that kind of popped up when I started poking around, one was Exit Through the Gift Shop, which is a feature-length documentary about Banksy, and Banksy is a street artist. I don't know if...
I was just reading about this. This sounds fucking awesome.
Totally, right? So, you know, if you're in Urban Outfitters, whatever, you sometimes come across Banksy's book and stuff like that.
And so, he's still completely anonymous. And I think – so didn't he make this movie?
Yeah. So
and the idea was that there was like a guy, right, who wanted to make a movie about him. And he was like, yeah, that's a great idea. Except, you know what? I'm going to make a movie about you.
Well, yeah. So I think there's a little tongue-in-cheekness going on here because it kind of gets into Charlie Kaufman territory in a way.
Right.
So there's a question of whether or not this is all just put on in a hoax and stuff. But yes, Banksy is a street artist that is anonymous. Like he obviously is kind of wanted by the police because he is a graffiti guy, right? Like he goes around and he puts. Yeah. And so it's about him, his friends, the street art movement, and like the whole idea of street art is, you know, you bring the gallery to the people, you don't bring the people to the gallery kind of thing. And so they're all kind of like anarchist, crazy, like counterculture guys. Shepard Fairey, the street artist that did the Obey campaign that also turned into the Obama poster and stuff like that, features prominently in the movie. And I've just I watched the trailer 2 weeks ago when we were preparing for the previous episode, and I can't get it out of my mind. It's just too funny, and I keep on thinking of instances that happened in the trailer, and I keep laughing about it, and I go back on the internet and watch the trailer again because it's too good. So they have the usual title cards come up at the beginning of the trailer, like Best Picture, and then it's like Of Leaves in a Trailer. and then it's like con, you know, and the little and the leaves around the wood can, and
the
it's just like, yeah, and then it's just like can is a nice place to visit, right? And then it just goes off from there, and so it's releasing next week in Canada. It got great reviews at Sundance. There's been a couple reviews that I've read of it so far. I'm really excited about this movie.
Like Basquiat meets Airplane.
Well, they get chased by the cops and stuff like that. So and they've got footage of it, and I can't tell if it's reenacted or if they're actually being chased by security and stuff.
I'm totally jacked up to see that. That's a good one.
Right. And then the second kind of under the radar one was Restrepo. And this has the strapline, 1 year, one platoon, one valley. And this was the movie that got me onto last week's endorsement for Matterhorn by Marlantes, which I mentioned. And that's because one of the filmmakers is Sebastian Younger, and Sebastian Younger wrote Fire, and he wrote A Perfect Storm, and he's just kind of like a gonzo outdoor journalist. He writes for Outside a lot.
He's more man than you and me and every guy we know rolled into one.
Yeah, he's got more man in his little pinky finger, right? And so him and his good friend, who's a documentarian, kind of decamp to this valley outpost in the Kongrel Valley, I think it's called, in Afghanistan, and they just hung with these guys and obviously, when you are there for a year, you can capture all kinds of crazy material that will make a compelling 2 hours. So I've seen the trailer for this. I'm excited about that. I hope it comes for wide release. If it doesn't, obviously, I'll catch up with it on iTunes. But it looks intense, and it's just kind of my kind of thing. And then the third movie that I was pimping 2 weeks ago was a French movie, and at the time I thought it was called Mesrine, or Mesrine, so however you want to pronounce that with a French accent. So it is alternately titled Public Enemy Number 1, and And so there's conflict, obviously, with the recent Johnny Depp movie. So I don't know how this is going to be marketed or if it's going to also see a wide release in North America or not. But it's a French film. It stars Vincent Cassel, and he's kind of channeling Steve McQueen from The Getaway. He plays it's a biopic, a true life story of a French bank robber from the 1970s that did like 34 heists, had 4 prison breaks, and was kind of in the media, and was a bit of a media darling in the 70s as he robbed his way around the country. So hopefully we'll see that. It was released in France over a year ago. So the fact that Miramax or whoever is going to distribute it here is a good sign. Right. I just don't know if it's going to get a wide release. So that is our condensed movie discussion. Probably better done than it
probably
was.
Probably the today. Better for the condensation.
Yeah, no. the condensation or the... Yeah. So, why don't we get into your 2 book recos. You are endorsing a graphic novel and a book of short stories. Which are you going to do first?
First, I'm going to talk about Things We Didn't See Coming by Stephen Amsterdam. So this is a book that I picked up on very little. Normally when I, you know, get a book to read, I know quite a bit about it going in. This is a first book by this guy, Stephen Amsterdam. He's a transplanted New Yorker now living in Australia. And this was originally published by an Australian publisher. I think it was one of their first books. They're sort of an indie startup. And it's not really it's a collection of short stories, and it's not really a collection of short stories. There's 9 stories or 9 chapters, depending on how you look at it. So it's difficult to describe, but basically you could read them as 9 stories about the same character at different stages in his life between about age 6 and age 40. Or you could read them as 9 completely independent short stories about 9 completely different people. Or you could read some of them as connected, because there's 3 shorts. The narrator is never named, but there's 3 of them that feature a secondary character who is named. Her name is Margot, and she turns up in 3 of them, and it appears to be the same character in all 3. So that's never clear, not to its detriment. So basically, to give the setup, the very first story is the story of – or first chapter is the story of a family that is kind of fleeing the city. It's New Year's Eve 1999 as it turns into 2000, and the father is having a sort of paranoid meltdown about the millennium bug and has packed the station wagon with supplies, and they're going to his wife's parents' house out in the country so that they can be out of the city when, you know, the apocalypse happens and society as we know it ends, and the wife – you know, is alternating between humoring him and being just completely, you know, frustrated and aggravated with him. And the child is kind of, you know, the narrator is kind of divided in his loyalties between his father and his mother, whom he loves. And that's basically the story. And you just sort of you kind of wait to see some kind of resolution where obviously the apocalypse doesn't happen and how that plays out, but it never quite gets there. And then in the second story, the narrator, maybe the same person, maybe not, is now much older, late teens, and some kind of apocalypse has happened. It's not the world as we know it. He's packed off to his grandparents' house, who now live in the city, and they want to go out into the country. And of course, there's armed guards and there's border checkpoints that you have to get through, and supplies are limited, and it's obviously there has been some kind of cataclysm and something has happened. And then it progresses from there, and every story takes place in this kind of post-cataclysmic environment, and you're never, again, because there's not a lot of exposition, you're never quite sure, is it all fallout from the same cataclysm, or are these just stories that all take place in a post-cataclysmic environment? And it's one, and this is kind of the theme of the evening. It's a book that I really, really enjoyed. It's a quick read. It's 9 stories, about 200 pages. But I also want to go back and I want to read it again, because, you know, it subverts a lot of your expectations. So now that I know what expectations are not going to be fulfilled, I want to kind of read it again. It's not as grim as The Road, but it's reminiscent of of the road, in the sense of the language is very spare and perfect, and there's an environmental tinge to everything that's going on, but really it's all just a lens with which to look at characters and to look at their relationships. And it was – sorry, go ahead.
No. So did you do any additional research? Because when you mentioned that you were endorsing this book, I was just like, I've heard of this book somewhere. This has got attention. I have like listened to him be interviewed, or I've read a review of him somewhere. Is this – was your sense that this thing was bubbling up?
Well, basically the way I came to it was I get the daily email from Publishers Weekly, and there was they just do a little section every day where it's like authors on the air. It's, you know, people who have TV or radio interviews or some kind of press coming up, and they showed the cover of the book, and I just sent this to you, and I was just really captured by both the title, Things We Didn't See Coming. I just found it really, really evocative. And then the typography of the cover, it's kind of the title is off to the right-hand side and then cut off, and then it's coming back around the left-hand side. So the ends of the title and the author's name are like the first things that you see. So that – I don't know. It just
– That echoes thematically –
It echoes thematically, but I just thought it was really – it was a clever title. It was a clever title treatment, and I was like, oh, cool. So I just popped it up on Indigo and got a short summary of what it was about, and really it was just saying that it was single character, kind of science fiction, a little bit post-apocalyptic. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? I'm in. I'm gonna check it out. And I haven't really done a lot of follow-up. It just won a big prize somewhere. I did see that. And I think it's definitely, you know, gaining some steam. But when I Googled it, I did not see a lot of big name reviews. I didn't see it reviewed in a lot of places like, you know, the New York Times or the New Yorker or what have you, the Globe, none of that. So I think it's building.
It sounds like my kind of thing. So I'm in. I think that you had me at post-apocalyptic, actually. So and it sounds like it's kind of a literary treatment. Post-apocalyptic novel, which I love. Reminiscent of the Road also is a good thing to say. So I had a good experience. I had a good experience with the Road, obviously. And right. and if he's aspiring to like half those heights, then I'm in. So let's move on.
Moving on to Asterios Polyp by David Mazzucchelli. So there was.
Whether or not we cut that out from the intro, I butchered his name and the book name from off the top of the show. That's why I'm laughing.
So there was two really big graphic novels in 2009 that got sort of all the lion's share of the critical and public acclaim. One of them I have already recommended on a show that I don't know if is ever going to see the air, but that one was Richard Starks Parker, The Hunter by Darwin Cook, the adaptation. So the other big graphic novel of 2009 was this book, Asterios Polyp by David Mazzucchelli. And so David Mazzucchelli, if you don't know who he is, in the mainstream comics world, he's probably most famous for two collaborations that he had with Frank Miller, who is the guy who did The Dark Knight Returns and Sin City and 300, which have been turned into movies. And he, as a writer, wrote two very famous arcs, one for Daredevil called Born Again and one for Batman called Year One. And they were both illustrated by David Mazzucchelli. And Mazzucchelli, a phenomenal artist. And so it's really interesting to contrast that earlier work, and that's from about 25 years ago, mid-80s, mid to late-80s, with this work now, because this is like that was just really accomplished storytelling and illustration. This is some insane quantum leap. And obviously, he's been working since then, but he largely just dropped off the mainstream map, got very into the New York comic scene. People like Chris Ware and Art Spiegelman, who did Mouse. Chris Ware did Jimmy Corrigan's Smartest Boy on Earth. And so in 1994, he did an adaptation of Paul Auster's City of Glass that is still, it's like it's was acclaimed and then went out of print and then now has come back into print and is probably the seminal New York graphic novel. But for the last 10 years, he's been working on this book, Asterios Polyp, and it is a bona fide masterpiece. It like blew the doors off my brain like nothing. That as much as I loved Parker, Darwin Cook's Parker, that was just a really, really tight, accomplished genre piece. This is a whole order of cartooning entirely. So the story is, Asterios Polyp is the main character. He's this guy, he's 50 years old. He's what they call a paper architect. He's got a ton of acclaim as an architect, but none of his buildings, none of his designs have ever been made into actual buildings. He was a professor at an upstate New York, an upstate college in New York. And as the story opens, he's 50 years old. He's alone. He's divorced. He's depressed. And literally a bolt of lightning hits his apartment building and burns down his apartment. And so he's thrust out into the world with basically a few mementos and a wallet full of cash and ends up in this small town called Apogee, where he takes a job as a mechanic with this eccentric mechanic and his even more eccentric wife and family. And that's sort of your A plot going through it. And then in flashback, you see his youth and then his time as a teacher and his marriage, which has since ended, to this modern artist named Hannah. And you also get parts of the story that are narrated by his identical twin who was stillborn and so never lived. And then there's other sequences which are very sort of impressionistic. And it just all feeds into, it's an incredibly literary book. And but at the same time, from the very get-go, as soon as his apartment burns down and he's just sort of kicked out into the world, it immediately jumps over that hurdle of the really navel-gazing story about a New York intellectual, and just, you know, and just gets him out of that and gets him moving forward and gets him moving towards where it ends up. So it's just a wonderfully touching and humanistic and romantic story just on the pure plot and character level. But then also within the book, and I can't, it's very difficult, I don't have the visual vocabulary to properly describe it, but there are motifs of color. There are illustrative elements that he uses to distinguish all of the characters in terms of the font that he uses for their speech balloons, and just the way that he draws all of the characters is very different from character to character, and everything is saying something about those characters and how different characters relate. There are visual tricks that he uses. To call them tricks is just to sell them short, but they just speak to the character's philosophy about duality. They speak to the nature of love and human interaction. They speak to the history of art and the actual act of trying to represent reality in an illustrated way. I could go on and on, but I don't know if I'm going to say anything meaningful about it. It's a masterpiece. It's the kind of book that's going to be talked about forever, and it's the kind of book that demands to be reread and re-reread, and I just adored it.
So not only did this pop up on a number of critics' best of 2009 yes. lists, it popped up as some of the best of the decade.
Yeah.
And when you have, you know, when you have books from 2009 show up on the 2010 best of the decade list, it's just like, okay, is that there because of proximity, meaning that you just reviewed this last week and that's why it's at the, you know, forefront of your brain and that's why it's made the best of list. But then that happened a number of times with people that I follow and really respect and stuff. And so I'm hearing the same from you. This is the kind of once in a generation kind of graphic novel.
Yeah, it's I would love to put this in your hands, but also put Batman Year One in your hands so you can see the artist, you know, 25 years ago and see him today, and you just won't believe it's the same guy.
So my one reservation is for those people out there that aren't graphic novel readers, is this a safe introduction, right? So the New York intellectual novel is a whole subgenre, right? And so if you were to put this into the hands of someone that's familiar with that genre, you could walk away rest assured that they would have a good time with this.
Absolutely. This the book, I mean, it has, even if you're not paying any attention to the formalist elements in the book, it has just a wonderful characters and a humor to it and an interesting story. And it's, you know, romantic and humane, and at the same time, it kind of teaches you the language that you need to understand the things that it's doing visually within the book itself. It is that accomplished.
Right on, right on. Okay, so why don't we wrap it up there? Yeah, so we hope you have enjoyed the show. Please visit us at enthusiasticcast.com, where we will hopefully post some trailers and some links for some of the movies that we mentioned, and obviously links to both of John's recommendations for this week. You can subscribe to the RSS feed on the blog, which is in the bottom right-hand corner of the page. We're not yet on iTunes. Hopefully, we'll get there soon. Until then, check back. you can check for the next episode on the blog. Until then, I'm Mark.
And I'm John.
And thanks very much for your time.